with Annie Humphrey, Keith Sokola, Jeremy Oldesacker, and S. Carey is available at thecedar.org.
Fresh Air Community Radio is KFAI FM, Minneapolis, St. Paul. Online and archived at kfai.org. It's where community grows.
You are listening to North Star Stories, Voices from Where We Live, a daily newscast about what it means to live in Minnesota.
In today's segment, Minnesota launches a program for sustainable agriculture. Then, a reminder from the state fire marshal for the colder months. And a new paid leave program will take effect in Minnesota in January. I'm Gracie J. The Minnesota Department of Agriculture is now taking applications for its new green fertilizer grant program. The initiative offers up to $3.8 million to support agricultural and rural electric cooperatives investing in renewable fertilizer production. Green fertilizers made from water, air, and renewable energy help cut greenhouse gas emissions and stabilize costs for farmers. Applications are due by December 2nd. In today's main story, as we head into the colder months, the state fire marshal is warning all Minnesotans about a silent killer. Jose Osoria tells us how to protect ourselves.
Emergency.
It's been called the silent killer.
What's the location?
About 14 people die from carbon monoxide poisoning in Minnesota each year, with hundreds more visiting the emergency rooms due to exposure.
It's a poisonous toxic gas to humans. What it does is it competes with oxygen to adhere to our red blood cells. So as we inhale carbon monoxide, it effectively inhibits our ability to carry oxygen throughout our bodies.
Daniel Cryer is the state fire marshal, with the arrival of colder weather prompting Minnesotans to light fires and turn on furnaces. The state is aggressively trying to educate Minnesotans about the threat that carbon monoxide poses.
As there's more education available, people are becoming aware of, that might not just be the seasonal flu, that might not just be a headache, that could be linked to something else, such as carbon monoxide, because the symptoms of exposure to carbon monoxide very much mirror flu-like symptoms.
We are out here advocating for alarms in every home because that is the only way that you will know that you have this monster that is a killer in your home.
Cheryl Burt knows firsthand how dangerous and fatal carbon monoxide poisoning can be.
We were sick. Me and my three children, stay-at-home mom, me and my three children were home all the time. And I had a sinus headache the whole time. I mean, I couldn't even, sometimes just talking hurt. And we'd be to the doctor. My kids would be lethargic when they would wake up.
Unfortunately, this was only a precursor. Cheryl and her family became victims of carbon monoxide poisoning.
I follow all the safety rules. My kids had bike helmet, knee pads and elbow pads and a car seat. And I did all the safety stuff that a mother would do. And yet my children still died of something that I was powerless to stop.
But people do have the power to protect themselves by having a carbon monoxide detector and ensuring it works. Recently, the federal government awarded Minnesota a grant to prevent such tragedies from happening, State Fire Marshal Daniel Cryer.
To purchase carbon monoxide alarms and to work with local fire departments to have them installed. So we've purchased 2,500 carbon monoxide alarms to be installed in 8 communities across the state.
Had we plugged this in, my whole entire life would be so different. So I don't want anyone to experience the pain of carbon monoxide, the pain of losing any loved ones.
Minnesotans can pick up a carbon monoxide detector at their local fire station. For North Star Stories, I'm Jose Osoria.
You are listening to North Star Stories. The Department of Employment and Economic Development is reminding employers to set up their paid leave accounts. Officials say the program will help Minnesota stand out as one of the best states for children and families. Employers must designate a paid leave administrator and notify employees about the new benefits. The new program is expected to make planning for life events easier for workers by offering job protections and better compensation.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
In today's broadcast, a proposed natural cemetery sparks controversy. Then, how some organizations are using food as medicine. And a new scam targets consumers' mobile wallets. I'm Chantel Sings. A proposed natural cemetery in eastern Minnesota is at the center of a federal court case. Several news outlets report the 20-acre site in Black Hoof Township, owned by a New Jersey nonprofit, would become Loving Earth Memorial Gardens, a 512-plot natural cemetery. In this newly approved practice, the body is placed in a biodegradable material to decompose fully and return to nature. But neighbors worry about soil and water safety. A judge is expected to rule on the case in the next few months. Next, food insecure households are at least 2 to 3 times more likely to suffer heart disease, diabetes, and high blood pressure. Britt Ahmet speaks with Minnesota organizations that are providing food for hunger and health.
The idea of food as medicine has been with humanity for thousands of years and has been shared across cultures. But nearly a million people, about 1 in 10 individuals in Minnesota, don't have enough food. This is according to data provided by Second Harvest Heartland. And the state's largest hunger relief organization noticed something else too after a survey of its clients.
People who are food insecure are much more likely to face chronic disease.
Robin Manthe is the director of Second Harvest Neighbor Services. She says the reasons why food insecure folks are more prone to chronic illness are multifaceted.
Inconsistent access to food and nutritious food, the stress of that, the quality of the nutrition you're getting, those are all contributing to these challenging chronic health diseases.
Put another way, people who don't have enough to eat are often facing other stressors like inconsistent housing and transportation. They may live in a food desert without a proper grocery store where the cheapest and most available meals are the junk foods we're supposed to avoid. Robin says this can impact long-term health.
If you are food insecure, you are 2 to 3 times more likely to face diabetes. You're 6 times more likely to have heart disease, and you're 2 times more likely to have high blood pressure.
For almost a decade, the Second Harvest program, FoodRx, has helped Minnesotans who are both food insecure and already dealing with at least one chronic disease.
We are really excited that in Minnesota, some of our health systems, as well as some of our Medicaid insurers, understand this connection of food as medicine. They partner with us to identify patients that they serve who are food insecure and have chronic disease, and then are able to basically prescribe them this medically tailored food box.
So in addition to prescribing insulin or high blood pressure pills, the doctor of a food insecure patient can also prescribe a monthly box of food curated for that individual's health needs. FoodRx also comes with food education and nutrition coaching. Combining nutrition with conventional medicine is also a win for healthcare providers.
We know, based on Fairview's own data, that patients experiencing food insecurity are nearly twice as likely to be readmitted to the hospital.
Kate Henschel is a coordinator with Fairview Health Services Food as Medicine program, Fair Table.
Food as medicine is really just thinking about making sure that all people have the food that they need to thrive.
You can find out more about FoodRx at 2harvest.org. This is Britt Ahmet for North Star Stories.
You are listening to North Star Stories. Watch your wallet. Scammers are using a tactic called ghost tapping to charge tap-to-pay cards and mobile wallets without contact. Fraudsters may crowd you, pose as vendors, or rush donations to slip through small charges that add up. To protect yourself, monitor card statements, enable transaction alerts, shield your card or phone with RFID protection, and ask for receipts before you tap.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
In today's stories, Greater Minnesota is getting a boost in housing and infrastructure. Then, a state Supreme Court decision regarding transgender athletes. And a major national trade show moves to the Twin Cities. I'm Gracie J. Well, 10 northern Minnesota communities are receiving hundreds of thousands of dollars in state grants for housing, infrastructure, and commercial rehabilitation projects, according to Amper's member station, KAXE. The funding comes from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. The Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development Commissioner says the grants will help strengthen local economies and improve the quality of life, ensuring Minnesotans have safe and healthy homes no matter where they live. Next, the Minnesota Supreme Court made a landmark decision supporting the rights of transgender athletes. Catherine DeSalle has more about the case and the reactions to the ruling.
The decision was unanimous. It was historic.
That's Minnesota Senator Erin May Quaid, who also serves as an advisor at Gender Justice, a legal and policy nonprofit advocating for gender equity. Senator Quaid is referring to a recent ruling from the Minnesota Supreme Court in the case of Cooper v. USA Powerlifting.
Gender Justice took this case back in 2019. We knew even then that there was a messaging campaign orchestrated by anti-LGBTQ hate groups to deny trans people basic rights.
In 2019, Minnesota athlete J.C. Cooper applied to join USA Powerlifting, a nonprofit organization that organizes competitions for athletes competing in powerlifting, a strength sport with the goal of lifting a maximum amount of weight. Jess Braverman is the legal director at Gender Justice and an attorney for J.C. Cooper.
J.C. Cooper got a membership card to compete in the female category. She's a woman, and everything was fine until it came time for her to sign up for some competitions.
It was then that USA Powerlifting found out JC was trans and would not let her compete.
They said, we do not allow transgender athletes to compete in any women's events. They had a policy of banning transgender women from women's events.
JC went to Gender Justice for help. What followed was a four-year legal battle that went to the Minnesota Supreme Court.
We brought a lawsuit under the Minnesota Human Rights Act suing USA Powerlifting for discriminating against JC based on the fact that she's transgender.
The Minnesota Human Rights Act prohibits discrimination in employment, housing, education, and public accommodations based on race, religion, disability, sex, sexual orientation, and gender identity.
This case was really not motivated by any type of discriminatory motive based on Ms. Cooper's gender identity.
In their defense, USA Powerlifting's attorney, Ancis Viskinens, presented scientific studies to the claim that athletes assigned male at birth maintain a performance advantage over athletes assigned female at birth.
It had everything to do with the fact that she's bigger and stronger than most of the women who want to compete in the women's division.
Last month, the Minnesota Supreme Court ruled in favor of J.C. Cooper, saying that USA Powerlifting discriminated against her. USA Powerlifting will now have to change their policy, or they cannot operate in Minnesota. Gender Justice and supporters of J.C. say they hope Minnesota can be a role model for other states in the inclusion, celebration, and protection of transgender athletes. For North Star Stories, I'm Catherine DeSalle.
You are listening to North Star Stories. North America's largest outdoor industry gathering, the Outdoor Retailer Show, is moving to Minneapolis in August of next year. The event will feature new collaborations, innovation showcases, and sustainability discussions through a leadership village led by athletes and industry experts. Organizers say the move highlights Minnesota's $13.3 billion outdoor recreation economy and strong business community. Local leaders say hosting Outdoor Retailer will boost jobs, partnerships, and innovation across the outdoor industry.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
Today, a call to collect bows of love for a future memorial. Then, a proposal to reopen an old prison is raising questions in the western part of the state. And 10 northeastern counties are getting on-demand transportation. I'm Chantel Sings. After the August tragedy at the Parish of the Annunciation, thousands of bows of love appeared across the Twin Cities as a symbol of unity and support. Now, as winter approaches, the community group Bows of Love is asking residents to help collect bows from public places. The group plans to repurpose them into a creative memorial. Residents are encouraged to save or move bows onto private property until official collection details are announced. In today's main story, concern is growing about the possibility of reopening the Prairie Correctional Facility in West Central Minnesota as an ICE immigration detention center. Jose Osoria reports.
Appleton in Western Minnesota has an empty prison located on the edge of town, which closed in 2010. Core Civic, the private company that owns the Prairie Correctional Facility, seems to see a profitable opportunity. They plan to expand their partnership with the federal government, converting some of their prison facilities into ICE detention centers.
We are optimistic that we will be successful in obtaining contract awards to activate additional idle facilities, especially now that historic funding levels for border security and immigration detention have been obtained.
That was Core Civic's then CEO, Damon Hininger, in a 2025 earnings call describing the potential profitability of expanding their partnership with the federal government. Former Core Civic CEO Damon Hininger once again.
With the funding now in place, we clearly are seeing a lot of intensity, both at the national level with DHS and ICE leadership, but also seeing it play out in field offices where they're engaging us on tours.
Shauna Kiefer is a Minnesota criminal defense attorney. She points out the problems that such a large influx of detainees presents.
I believe that this facility has a capacity for 1,600 inmates, which is larger than the town that it's housed in. If it's expected that those people's only access to justice will come from our local community, which already doesn't have the resources to serve the people that they are serving, it's going to be a nightmare.
Ms. Kiefer believes there are some serious problems associated with a private company providing prison detention services.
There's so many red flags to having a private entity being involved in the criminal justice system, because it becomes more about profit than justice, and the goal of the justice system is always justice.
We know that Appleton is struggling economically. We know that a reopened prison detention center would support the economy of this community. This is one of the ways, my friends, that vulnerable communities, oppressed communities, are pitted against one another.
That was the sound of a recent protest held in Appleton by Minnesota community activist organizations. Ms. Kiefer points to Core Civic's disturbing track record with immigrant detainee safety.
I know that there's been a number of lawsuits around the country regarding the treatment of immigrants in their facilities. The one in California had 19 reported incidents of employee on inmate detainee sex abuse incidents in the year of 2019. And so that's their employees sexually assaulting immigrants who might not even be criminals.
Currently, there's no clear answer as to the fate of the Appleton facility. Core Civic responded to our request for an interview with a statement from their spokesperson, Ryan Gustin, saying, quote, "We continue to explore opportunities with our government partners, for which our Prairie Correctional Facility would be a viable solution," end quote. For North Star Stories, I'm Jose Osoria.
You are listening to North Star Stories. Arrowhead Transit, located in the northeastern part of the state, is partnering with a routing company to introduce an on-demand transit service across 10 counties. The partnership uses TRC's Pingo platform to power both scheduled and dial-a-ride services, improving access in rural and underserved communities. Riders will be able to book trips in real time with optimized routing for greater efficiency. Officials say the system will be fully operational by early 2026, marking a major step toward more connected rural transportation.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
In today's segment, the state is investing in revitalizing old properties. Then a group of students fights a federal lawsuit. And as the election day approaches, know your rights and rules at the polls. I'm Gracie J. The Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development is investing nearly $2.3 million to revitalize five sites across the state. The projects will create or retain 269 jobs, add $2.4 million to local tax bases, and spur more than $157 million in private investment. The state will transform nearly 34 acres and create 488 new housing units. The department says the programs help communities breathe new life into old properties and strengthen local economies. Next, Minnesota's DREAM Act has helped hundreds of undocumented students pay in-state tuition for more than a decade. Now, the federal government says it violates federal rules. Zan Holston has more.
This summer, the Department of Justice, or DOJ, sued Minnesota over its DREAM Act, a state law that provides a path for undocumented immigrant students to pay in-state college tuition rates if they meet certain requirements. The DOJ is accusing Minnesota of violating a 1996 federal law that bans states from giving undocumented students access to college financial aid on the basis of residency unless it offers the same benefits to all U.S. citizens, regardless of whether they live in that state.
We know that the federal government has made it a priority to attack and villainize immigrants of all stripes, and in particular, undocumented immigrants.
That's Minnesota Assistant Attorney General Joe Ritchie. He said the state law was written carefully to stay within the limits of federal law. Eligibility for the Minnesota DREAM Act isn't based on state residency, but whether a student attended a Minnesota high school for 3 years and meets other academic and filing requirements.
Nobody thought this was an issue until now, and I think that speaks volumes.
Minnesota is far from the only state with a DREAM Act. Texas was the first to pass one back in 2001 under Republican Governor Rick Perry. And since then, more than 20 other states have followed suit.
And if you look at the states that enacted laws enabling people to go to get an affordable college education, regardless of immigration status, it's blue and red states altogether. It was not a partisan issue.
Still, the DOJ has recently taken aim at DREAM Act states, including Texas, Oklahoma, and Kentucky. The attorneys general in those three states agreed to end their programs instead of going to trial, effectively conceding before any judge ruled on the issue.
Setting aside these consent judgments, no court has ever found that any state's law violates the federal law that is being asserted here.
They were specifically targeting immigrants, people who were receiving those programs, because they said that they are discriminating against U.S. citizens.
Jordi Hualpa Uribe is a member of immigrant rights group COPAL's Youth Committee. He and Vivi Seeger, the Youth Committee coordinator, said the DOJ's case misses the real purpose of the DREAM Act, which serves not only undocumented students, but also those with temporary protected status.
You know, you could be a student with authorization just not to receive federal aid. So you could be legally working or had your asylum application approved and you're just waiting for your social security number.
Last month, COPAL's Youth Committee invited State Attorney General Keith Ellison to a press conference, publicly thanking him for defending the state's programs.
We wrote a letter of gratitude to show appreciation of like the efforts that he's done for Minnesota, and that we're also watching.
The government shutdown has put the case on pause, and the DOJ was unavailable for comment. Still, COPAL's youth see the support from AG Ellison as a sign that they're not alone in their fight for opportunity.
We just need leaders who support us, support our students.
For North Star Stories, I'm Zan Holston.
You are listening to North Star Stories. Are you ready for Election Day? Polls are open Tuesday, November 4th from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. You can find your polling place on the Secretary of State's website. Campaigning is banned within 100 feet of the building, and voters may not wear political materials or display campaign messages. If your registration is current, you do not need an ID in Minnesota. And remember, you have the right to take time off of work to vote. For more information, visit mnvotes.gov.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
Welcome to Minnesota Native News. I'm Marie Rock. This week, a special extended interview from a past segment. Travis Zimmerman interviews award-winning author, activist, and chef Sean Sherman about releasing a new cookbook this month and opening a new restaurant in spring of 2026.
My name is Sean Sherman. I am the executive director at NATIFS, which is North American Traditional Indigenous Food Systems in Minneapolis. NATIFS has the Indigenous Food Lab, which has the market space, a classroom studio, production kitchen. My restaurant, Awamini, is also a part of the nonprofit, so it's under NATIFS also. And I also founded the Sous Chef in 2014, done a lot of work there. And I'm from Pine Ridge, South Dakota. I'm enrolled with the Oglala Lakota.
So I saw you out in Palm Springs here a couple of weeks ago. And yeah. It was good to see you. You got an award from the Association of Tribal Archives, Libraries, and Museums, otherwise known as ATOM. Can you tell us a little bit about what that award was?
Yeah, I mean, it's a Trailblazer Awards, just for a lot of the work that we've been doing of really just trying to bring Indigenous food ways into a larger conversation, just trying to be role models of what we can do. And I feel very lucky that we get this kind of attention because it just helps us broaden our platform to be able to have a louder voice. Just been a lot of nods to this work, I should say, you know, but again, for me, like this work was never about myself personally. It's great that I get these awards. I feel like it just helps open up the doors for other people. All I want to do is just, you know, leave this world a better place down the road.
Why don't you tell what's next for Natives?
Well, I'm working on a new restaurant concept that would open up in Minnesota this next year in Minneapolis. And so that if it works out, that brings around a new restaurant concept for people to try out. So something a little bit different, a little bit lower price point than Awamini. I think it'll be a lot of fun. But we're also just moving forward with creating institutional food support, meaning the formats that schools and hospitals utilize so that we can give them options. So a lot of our schools and hospitals, of course, just utilize a lot of these food products from Sysco's and Aramark's and US Foods and these kinds of big box trucks, you know, Sodexo's and stuff like that. And so we want to start creating healthy Indigenous foods, making sure that we're making recipes with Indigenous ingredients that we purchase from tribal communities or individuals or entities, whatever it might be. So we're just trying to figure out ways to get food out there, which is why we're moving into this institutional food support of making foods for schools and hospitals and penitentiaries or whoever else is using large format food service. At the same time, just creating a way to distribute these products and move them around, whether it's in retail form or wholesale form, because we can move big bags of stuff around too. And our goal is to start to work with all the tribes so we can eventually start sending this food out all across the state. And then that goal is to just continue to grow that. And then we'll probably start doing that same program up in Montana. The restaurant here in Minnesota is part of the nonprofit because we use that for primarily job creation, because we have 100 employees at Awamini and about 70% of our staff identifies as Indigenous, which is a pretty big number for a city like Minneapolis. And to set up a lot of the same models that we built here with the Indigenous Food Lab, we're able to move nearly $1 million a year directly to Indigenous food producers because of our purchasing power. So like we have a lot of fun things that we're just trying to create and grow. And, you know, we're just open because we want to help other people create concepts. We can help tribes create Indigenous food service concepts for their casinos and communities. You know, we can always be here to train and develop anybody who wants to move into food production, whether it's like a community center or a museum. And it can be hard. So we just want to try to figure out ways to get, you know, food product directly into communities like that, especially, you know, in places like where I grew up on Pine Ridge, where we just have, you know, we're dotted with a few gas stations or nowadays there's a couple of fast food restaurants, but, you know, there's not a lot of healthy nutritional food access, especially in the form of native foods. There's a big book that comes out next year. So my second cookbook will be out next year. I did that with Kate Nelson here in Minnesota, who's a native journalist and writer. Also, Kristen Donnelly, who lives out east, but we put together this massive book that'll be basically focused on Turtle Island. So it looks at North America, Mexico through Alaska, and all of the Indigenous diversity that's out there, but doing it through a cookbook form.
That's awesome. Wow, man. Keep it up and hope to see you around here soon.
Absolutely. Well, appreciate that.
That's all for this week's episode. Join us next time for more voices and stories that inform, uplift, and shape our communities. Right here on Minnesota Native News. Minnesota Native News is produced by AMPERS, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and the citizens of Minnesota.
Join KFAI for the 22nd Balkanicus Concert, Autumn Reflections.
Artsy and folky, emotional, upbeat, and irregular. And at the end of it, meet performers and fellow music lovers over a tasty Mediterranean reception. You'll hear a variety of favorite pieces from the past few decades of the Balkanikus concert series, featuring music from Bulgarian, Serbian, Slovenian, and Minnesotan composers. Balkanikus will even premiere a few pieces new to America.